Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Essie Adugin is a brilliant author who calls Victoria, British Columbia, home. Her 2011 novel, Half-Blood Blues, is a critically acclaimed masterpiece chronicling the lives of American jazz musicians in Berlin and Paris, just as World War II altered history forever. The book won several accolades and awards, including Canada's prestigious Scotiabank Giller Prize. Essie arguably topped that novel with 2018's remarkable historical epic, Washington Black, which chronicles the saga of a young precocious boy who flees a plantation during the slave trade with an abolitionist who leads him on a fascinating planet-wide quest for knowledge and personal truth. Washington Black also garnered worldwide acclaim, and again, in a rare feat, won Essie the Scotiabank Giller Prize. Essie and I connected recently for a conversation about her life, how she got into writing, and her early inspirations, the connection between great literature and cinema, the music she listened to while writing her most recent works, a dive into the action and genesis of Half-Blood Blues and Washington Black, what's next for her, and more. With the support of listeners like you who subscribe to this podcast and spread the word about it and make flexible monthly pledges at patreon.com/creativecontrol, plus in-kind support from CFRU 93.3 FM, Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, this is the 463rd episode of Creative Control, featuring one of the world's most gifted writers, Essie Adugin, with your host, me, Vish Khanna.
Of course, the cart was hard, and it almost killed me up. But just to leave it go, boy, it was my cup. I've got those cold cart blues till I really don't know what to do.
Hi, Essie. How are you?
Hi, Vish. I'm well. How are you doing?
I'm very well. I'm very well. I shouldn't say I'm very well. I'm doing a thing in February where I try to go vegan for the month.
Oh, okay.
I don't. Have you? Are you a vegetarian? Have you experimented with anything like that?
You know, I was a vegetarian for 7 years, but I did eat dairy at the time. Like I ate eggs and cheese. So it wasn't that big of a deal. I couldn't imagine going vegan. I think that would be quite a challenge, but
I was a vegetarian or pescatarian for 20 years. And then I lapsed once my son. I have two children, and my son turned around three, and then my wife has always eaten meat, and then the idea of having the time and the money to prepare separate meals for them and for me just went so I gave in a little bit, and that was in its way liberating. You said you were a vegetarian for 7 years, and then you went, did you go, now you eat meat? Is that what happened?
Yeah, I do eat meat, and actually now I don't eat dairy because I found out that I'm allergic to dairy, which was something I had no idea about for many years. So, but I do eat meat, and it seems to be working for me.
Do you find it liberating on some level?
No, I don't find it liberating. I guess I don't think of it in those terms, maybe. I just, I guess I find it satisfying. I'm trying to eat less meat, though, just because I've been, reading about just the environmental effects
Yes,
of eating
absolutely.
so much meat. So I'm trying to eat less. But it's kind of hard to get some of my family members to eat legumes. It's very weird. There's this
Oh.
whole mental block around legumes.
Well, one of the reasons I'm endeavoring to this with this experiment, because I, like I say, I had a history of vegetarianism. In a sense, veganism is not that far a stretch from that. You just have to make your choices. But it was an ecological thing, and also I just hadn't been feeling well. And what I meant by liberating is, I will say that once I stopped being a pescatarian or vegetarian, it felt like I could eat anything, and I felt less like a pill. You know, with people saying, "Ah, you didn't make something for me." What? You know, I started to feel that self-consciousness of like, I can't eat certain things and my kids are eating whatever they want. That's what I meant. So now the veganism is the opposite. Now I'm very careful and I'm trying to stick to it. I'm trying to keep a food journal going and all these sorts of things. So it's when I say I'm okay, this has just started. As we're speaking, it's only a few, it's a, what, a week into February, and I'm still grappling with this. Anyway, enough about me. I just wondered if it sounds like you have some experience with what I'm going through, the transition.
Yeah, I guess so. I discovered I was allergic to dairy and some grain and all of this, so that's been a challenge. But I feel like, I'm living in kind of the right place to be fussy about these kinds of things because everybody has some kind of food fussiness, it seems, like on the
Yes.
West Coast. So people are used to kind of making substitutions, and yeah, I don't feel like so much of a pill, as you
Right.
said.
Yeah, it just went from a pride. I was proud of my substitutions. I was proud. And then it went from like, oh, it's a pain on some level. But now I'm back to feeling that pride again. Like I'm doing okay with it. You mentioned
Oh, that's good.
yeah, thank you. You mentioned you're on the West Coast. Where in the world are you today?
I'm in Victoria, on Vancouver Island. I've lived here for about 20 years on and off.
Nice.
Yeah.
20 years. And where are you from originally?
I'm from Calgary.
Oh, you're from Calgary. Okay, cool. My
Yeah, I was born and raised.
wife is from Edmonton, so I spend a fair amount of time in that. You know, that's the other thing. You go to Alberta for Christmas. It's a meat-a-palooza. You have to just so much meat. Did you eat a lot of meat in Calgary?
I guess so. I guess so. Yeah, I guess that's on offer quite a bit, especially around like Stampede time and stuff like that.
Yeah,
Yeah,
that's
I
that.
guess it was a pretty red meat heavy childhood.
Right. And then you moved to Victoria. Why?
I went to the University of Victoria to study writing
Okay.
when I was 17, so yeah.
It's a good place. It's a nice place. I've been to Victoria a few times. It has a vibe. Are you aware of the vibe, or are you immune to the vibe that I might
How
be
would you
speaking of?
characterize the vibe? I'm kind of
I don't.
curious.
Well, I've had a couple of weird incidents in. Well, it seems to have an older population, an older demographic.
So it's referred to, I don't know if it's still referred to like this, but certainly when I first moved here, they called it the home of the newlywed and the nearly dead. And
Yeah, that's about right.
I think that's still the vibe.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, it's a good place to retire because the climate is lovely, and you can sort of do stuff outside year round, and then you've got the university, which has just tons of people coming from other provinces and things like that. So it's yeah, there's like a really lively young population, I guess, in their 20s, and then a lot of people over 65, kind of thing.
Yeah, I guess
Yeah.
it's like it sounds when you put it that way, it's basically like anywhere else. But one of the first times I was there, I went to a concert and it had a curfew, and I didn't understand, like an early curfew too. Like it was a rock band from Chicago was there, and I was excited to see them, and they were told they had to stop at a certain time, and I just couldn't understand that.
Yes, there's a lot of that in terms of, clubs having to be closed at a certain time, and if they're not, then, there's a real fight to have them close earlier. It's very, that always bothered me when I was younger.
Yeah, that does not sound like a fun place, does it? But you're enjoying it.
I enjoy it. It's I'm old now. I don't do much clubbing. I don't, it doesn't affect me.
You have nicely aged into living in Victoria, is what you're saying.
I guess so. I live in a part of the city that's I think it's the fastest growing part of I guess place in BC in terms of people moving out here and houses being built. And it's a lot of, I guess, people my age.
Yeah.
Like sort of people with young families. And so that's my milieu.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. All right. No, yeah. I didn't mean to. This was not an interrogation about your happiness. I feel you sound like you're centered and happy there. That's good. That's good.
Yeah, I'm fine here.
You mentioned the university and going there for creative writing. And before we're going to talk about at least your latest novel, Washington Black, which I just think is stunning. If I might say, from over the phone line here. Unbelievable book,
Thank you, if I might say.
And I mean, you don't need to hear this from me. You just won the Giller Prize. You win all sorts of awards. You know you're good, right? You know you're kind of good at this point, I would think. Can you admit that? It's awkward. It's an awkward thing to admit, isn't
it? It's awkward because, and I think with every book, you're learning how to write that particular book. So
that's
you don't really feel good at that book while you're writing it. It's like a process of feeling your way through it. So, but yeah, I guess I've been doing it long enough that I've learned a few tricks.
And I mean, Half Blood Blues as well. I mean, these are the two works of yours that I'm most familiar with, and I just find them stunning. And I feel interrelated on some level, if I might say, and maybe we'll get into that. But I want to stop myself and go back to where I was first going with this question, which is you went to the University of Victoria? Is that the name of the school?
Yeah, that's right.
Right. So you went to that school for creative writing. Do you recall where the spark to get into writing kind of came from? When you were a younger version of yourself, before you aged into the right age to live in Victoria, when you were presumably a teenager or whatever, what have you, when did you start to explore writing in your personal expression?
I guess I was maybe about 13 when I, you know, I'd always been a big reader. Like as a child, I'd kind of read everything, and my parents were very, I guess in retrospect, it seems like this was very beneficial that they didn't really censor what we were reading. We kind of just took out whatever we wanted from the library. So I would read and read and read, and then I guess around 13 I started to jot things down, and you know, just like terrible poetry that I really hope I've gotten rid of. Nobody picks this up. Just like horrible stuff, but I really thought, okay, you know, I'd like to do that, but I didn't really think of it as something that you could do as a career until I was graduating from high school and had to figure out what I was going to study at school. And then I had a teacher who recommended that program. And then I applied and got in.
Okay.
So I did my undergraduate degree there. And then I went on to Johns Hopkins in Baltimore for my master's.
I see. Okay. So when you say you were reading when you were 13, were a voracious reader in your teens, and that your parents didn't censor you on some level in terms of what you had access to. Were there particular authors or books that spoke to you, people you read, you know, their canon, if you will, or books you reread because you found them fascinating or inspiring? Does anything come to mind?
When I was like 10, 11, 12, I was actually reading like B.C. Andrews, which is pretty traumatizing. Like, I don't think that's maybe the right age to read B.C. Andrews, but that was fascinating. And I think obviously there's also this illicit pleasure in being able to read that kind of stuff and nobody prying it from my fingers. And
yeah.
And so that stayed with me, even though I recognize that that's not, you know, great literature or anything like that. But, you know, V.C. Andrews, Dean Koontz, these kinds of writers.
I see. Okay.
But I was also reading, you know, I read J.D. Salinger. I used to reread Catcher in the Rye every year, or every time I got sick, I just found it really comforting. And then when I was a little bit older, like late teens, I started reading The Russians. So I read Crime and Punishment because somebody had recommended it. And then I kind of went on and started reading Tolstoy. So I read Anna Karenina. And this was all really eye-opening for me. I just was blown away.
Yeah, eye-opening in what particular sense? I'm just curious if you can expand upon that. Because that's, you know, you talk about reading is for a lot of people a kind of escapism, you know, it takes you away and you enter a new world. But for you, it was world changing in that you mentioned earlier, you know, I didn't think of this as a something you could do as a career, but at some point that struck you that maybe it was possible. So on some level, it was escapism. On some level, it was a route, a career route for you. And I find that kind of interesting. I don't know. Can you expand upon that? Was there a particular time in your life where you're like, you know what, I can do this. These people that I admire have done this and made a name for themselves and made a living. I'm going to try to do this. I think I can do this.
Yeah, I think you hope you can do it more than you think that you're qualified to do it. But I just remember reading like Crime and Punishment, and especially reading Anna Karenina, that one in particular. You have this idea of them before you actually read the work, like that this is like some very stuffy, you know, sort of very high art kind of work that's not at all going to speak to you, that it's going to be an accomplishment to read these books rather than, you know, that you're actually going to enjoy them.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think I was astonished to read Anna Karenina and see just how much these people, like, people haven't changed, and that these people were very warm and alive, and they came off the page, and that, you know, the way Tolstoy writes women is he sort of understood that there was fundamentally, intellectually, that there's, you know, maybe not such a huge gap between the way men and women think, although mm-hmm. there are differences. And so he just imbued them with such life and richness, and the way he writes children, again, like I just was blown away by the particularity of the detail the familiarity of the life experiences and the way everything was so, I mean, you're reading in translation, but it's, you know, so eloquently expressed, and it feels like he probably put a lot of attention to detail, like every single sentence just seemed, you know, beautifully thought out.
Yeah.
I don't know, as somebody who read widely, I guess something was turned on, and I just thought I want to try to do that, and I hope I can be good at that. And so that's, you know, that's where things started for me, at least.
I want to put, I want to apologize again for putting you on the spot earlier by telling you that you are, just a great person, and that obviously you're better than everyone else. I didn't mean to put it that way. You know what I mean?
I took it for a compliment.
It's an awkward thing to have to answer to, I'm sure. But no one's ever told me I'm the best at anything. So that's why I was like, "What? That must be nice to know that you might be. Consistently with each work, people are like, this is the best work that has come out over the last 12 months. That must affect you in some way. That's all. I didn't mean to. Now I'm making it more awkward by compliments.
Thank you for the compliment. I think it's lovely.
Yeah. Well, I wonder, we've talked about some of your literary influences. As I read your works, I can't help but think of other mediums, particularly in the realm of kind of action adventure. There's a very interesting interplay between amazing character study and narrative sophistication. But I also there's a suspenseful aspect to your work. There is often travel involved in your work, often searching for something. And trying to resolve interpersonal issues, among other issues. And I'm just curious if you are inspired by any other mediums, whether it be film might be the obvious one, film or television or something like that. Are there filmmakers, or musicians even? I mean, when we get into the realm of Half-Blood Blues, that's there as well. There's science, obviously, in Washington Black. But yeah, I'm just curious, is there any other aspect of creative expression that maybe inspires you in your work as a writer?
Yeah. I think if I'm inspired by, in terms of cinema, if I'm inspired by it, I think it's all very indirect. Like I don't think I could point to any particular films that I would say were very inspirational.
Yeah.
Definitely inspired by books. This is my main mode of inspiration, I guess, is especially nonfiction books. Like when you read about something that's just so fascinating, and you think, well, maybe this is something that could be, you know, brought to life in a work of fiction. I could delve into this, I can blow it up, I can create scenes around it. That's big. And in terms of music, I'm somebody who used to require complete silence when I was working. Like, it would just bother me if somebody coughed in the next room, kind of thing. But now it's, you know, since writing Half Blood Blues, or while I was working on it, I was listening to music like constantly. Always something on. I feel like that book was written to, you know, to a very particular soundtrack. And same with Washington Black. Like, I always had music on, and this kind of fed into the writing of it. It also helps you focus.
Was it music that might be related to the themes or storylines in any way? I mean, Half Blood Blues is a jazz-oriented story. Washington Black, I don't necessarily, I can't point to music per se in terms of the way it's depicted in the book. Maybe I'm blanking on something, but yeah, is there something that, is there a connection between what you wrote and the music you were listening to for both?
Certainly for Half Blood Blues, I was listening to a lot of jazz and a lot of blues. I listened to a lot of Miles Davis and obviously Louis Armstrong, who appears as a character in the book. You know, I listened to a lot of Ella Fitzgerald, like just, you know, and Thelonious Monk for the experimentalism.
Yeah.
And yeah, I just listened to tons, and it just fed right into the book. And for Washington Black, you know, you would never guess. Like, I listened to quite a bit of, I've listened to Bjork.
Oh.
A lot. Yeah, there were just some particular albums that just had this kind of barren landscape sound to them, if
right.
I could put it that way.
Yeah.
That just seemed so fitting and just felt so cold and just got very into that. And, you know, things like Radiohead and such.
I see. Things that are stark but affecting.
Yeah, that's a good way of summing it up.
Yeah.
Stark but affecting.
Yeah. I can hear that in the landscape of the book now that you mention it. I didn't mean to, and I don't mean to harp on the connection between cinema and literature, but it occurs to me, I've asked authors about this on the show before, and in some cases they're in the midst of having their novels or their writing optioned into TV shows, into movies. And one of the reasons I ask you this is because, you know, films are written. they are based on film scripts. They have a very literary aspect to them. And so there's a connection. And when I read your books, I like the idea that it's all occurring in my imagination. Like, everything that's I'm reading, I'm picturing, I can picture the characters. I know in my head they look a certain way, and I like that it's left to my imagination. Do you have any resistance to this notion of having your works adapted into like a fixed static film? Because for some people, they lose the book, that the book is left behind because the film has taken over the story on some level and taken over. And when that happens, people then read the book and all they can picture is what happened in the film. I just wonder, do you have any, I'm curious, maybe you've never even thought about this, but is that something that occurs to you when you're, in your own work, the book being sacred and everything else that might come after is sort of a whatever, it's not of interest to you?
You know, I think that screenwriting and cinema, like, that's its own beast. And so if somebody were to adapt your work, I think, at least in my thinking, you're kind of relinquishing something there.
Like, absolutely, yeah.
It becomes, you know, whatever is produced at the end of that process is just a different piece of art to my thinking. Like, it might share the same title or whatever, but it's its own thing. And it's probably a process that you shouldn't interfere with too steadily. Like, this is somebody else's vision, kind of based on your work. But I see what you're saying about maybe that becoming the main narrative around your story, but it's nothing I've had to, certainly nothing that I've had to deal with myself up to this point.
That's fascinating. I would think people would be clamoring to turn these stories into whatever, you know, series or a film or something.
Yeah. Well, Half Blood Blues has been optioned. I think it's on its second option. But nothing has been made.
Yeah.
You know, so it's, so I, you know, I haven't had to deal with these, I guess, these quandaries head on, but it's, to me, it just feels like it's a different beast. It's its own thing. It's the vision of the screenwriter and the director, and that it's, something divorced from what you've done.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think it's probably very interesting for people to compare the two and to have a dialogue about how they're different and which they preferred. And I always find that fascinating, like reading the book after I've watched the film,
yeah,
or vice versa. And but it is true that you do kind of get a face in your head of the actor, and it's hard to shake that. But I don't know. I guess that's a risk.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I want to dig into Washington Black a little bit with you. And I thought for the sake of people who haven't read the book yet, and also because I want to be, I'm always wary of spoiling a book when I speak with authors on the show. Can you do me and our listeners a favor and sort of summarize this book to the best of your ability, the plot and maybe some of the characters, just so we have it in your words?
Sure. So Washington Black is a novel set in the 1830s, and it follows 6 years in the life of a young field slave called George Washington Black, who's nicknamed Wash in the text. And Wash, he's 11 or 12 years old at the outset of the story. He's not entirely sure of his age. But he is, you know, he's somebody who has been a field slave most of his life. He's known no other life but one of hardship and brutality. And so he's utterly surprised to one day find himself taken to live in the quarters of his new master's brother. Mm-hmm. And this man is called Christopher Wilde.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Nicknamed Titch. And it's through Titch removing Wash from his field work and teaching him how to read and how to draw that Wash starts to come into himself, come into his own as a person. Like he starts to feel his first stirrings of personhood, and he starts to recognize that he's gifted, and this is obviously something that utterly transforms his life, mm-hmm. and Titch's life as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So this is a story set in the slave trade, and Titch is an abolitionist. That should be said.
Yes. So right. So Titch Wilde is he's totally unlike any other white man that Wash has known up until that point. He's
certainly the opposite of his brother as well.
Yeah, exactly. So he's an inventor, he's an illustrator, he's a naturalist, but he's also an abolitionist.
Right.
And this is obviously the thing that that hugely changes the course of Wash's life.
Yeah, and as I alluded to earlier, this becomes this kind of action adventure-y type of quest for both of them on some level. They travel, they must flee together. They are each searching for people in the end. Where did this story sort of come from for you? What were you already invested in these kinds of stories of the slave trade? I'm just curious how you conjured this, if you can articulate that. I know it can be difficult, but can you pinpoint where this story sort of came from, if you will?
Yeah, definitely. I'm not somebody who was deeply read or had, was obsessed with stories of the slave trade. But what happened was I came across a reference to a man called Andrew Bogle. So I don't know if you know much about the Tichborne claimant trial.
It doesn't sound, I've read a lot about this history, but I don't think that comes to, I mean, 20 years ago when I was in university, I took
Sure,
many
sure.
such courses, but that's not coming to mind at the moment.
Sure. So the Tichborne claimant affair was like this really infamous series of criminal trials that took place in England from about, sometime in the 1860s until sometime in the 1880s. And it was a huge cause célèbre, which sort of pitted the gentry against the working class. But it centered around the disappearance of a young man called Roger Tichborne. And he was this bon vivant who was basically thinking he was going to do a world tour. And then he was shipwrecked off the coast of Argentina. But his mother refused to believe that he had died because she was one of these, she was very attached to her son. She was like unnaturally attached to her son, and just, refused to believe that he perished. So she consulted a clairvoyant who told her that Roger was alive and well and that she just had to find him. She just had to send out some letters and he would respond. And so she did this. She sent out letters all around the world and got a response from Australia from a town called Wagga Wagga. And it came from a man called Tom Castro, but he basically said that that was an alias, and that he was Roger, and he was sorry that he had stayed away so long, but that and that he had been working as a butcher in a small Australian town, but that he was happy to come back and take up the mantle of the family estates and assume his inheritance.
I see. Okay, so this is a heavy influence on the characterizations in your book.
Yeah. So, she immediately, his mother immediately believed that this was him. But, she had like some modicum of sense rattling around up there, and she wanted to send an emissary out to this town to make the identification. And just, by chance, like 6 months before, their family servant, who was a man called Andrew Bogle, had retired to Sydney. And so she sent a letter to him asking him to go to Wagga Wagga and make the identification. And Andrew Bogle was, he had been in the family service, as I said, for 4 decades. But he was an ex-slave who had been stolen off a plantation in the Caribbean by a member of the Tichborne household, who had been visiting one afternoon and for a few weeks, and I guess had taken a liking to this slave boy and decided to take him to England. And so I thought I was going to do the whole Tichborne story through the eyes of Andrew Bogle. But then I realized I was maybe struggling with, this litigation that went on for nearly 30 years. It just seemed unwieldy and the story was just all over the place. And I realized I was much more interested in the mindset and the psychology of somebody who was like Bogle, not Bogle himself, but somebody like him, who was would have had, his thinking would have been that he was born on this plantation, he would probably die on this plantation, and probably under unnatural circumstances, and that his life was just going to look, be one of great brutality until he died prematurely. And so for him to be wrenched out of that and then, taken into worlds that were so entirely unlike everything that he'd known, that was what I was interested in. And then that ended up being the impetus for the book.
That's fascinating. That's utterly fascinating to me. There's also a strain of brutality in your book that is kind of jaw-dropping. The skirmishes, the violence that's depicted even on the plantation. I mean, knowing that history the way I do, I wasn't surprised, but it's still jarring. That was that new for you to explore that? I mean, it happened a little bit in Half Blood Blues too. When people fight in your works, things get messy. I'm curious: is that are these things you is that sort of an is that violence depicting that violence? Is that a fun exercise for you? Do you have to gear yourself up to like get into that section and be like, oh man, here we go?
Yeah, it's definitely not fun. I think, I think for both novels, Half Blood Blues was set obviously in the period preceding the Second World War. And then this one, of course, set during slavery.
Yeah.
There are moments of violence that you can't shy away from. You have to depict them.
Yeah.
It's especially with something like Washington Black. I mean, I would have preferred not to have opened the book with scenes of great violence. Like if you think about it just on a writing level in terms of attracting readers, I mean, this is something that's enormously risky.
Yes, there's likely
from an aesthetic perspective, because people can just decide to stop reading. You have to, they have to put their trust in you.
Yes.
But it was really important for me to, as I started reading about how slavery manifested in the Caribbean and what this young man's life would have looked like, it was really important for me to depict those details frankly and also to get them right. Like not to invent cruelties, because that was totally unnecessary. I mean, the cruelties themselves were already so, just terrible.
Yeah.
And I felt like to honor those lives, it was important to depict them as they were, but also to depict them, period. Like not to shy away, not to try and sort of gloss over them.
The furthest thing from sugar-coated.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mentioned earlier that I see a through line between Half-Blood Blues and Washington Black. Has this been brought to your attention in any way already? I mean, obviously you're the common denominator here, but in terms of these books both being kind of recollections of the past, having these fraught relationships, people searching for each other on some level, searching for people over unresolved issues regarding their relationships, and also kind of thinking about these people that were very important to them during formative moments in their lives. I mean, those kinds of things echo between the books for me. Has that occurred to you at all?
No, I like the parallels that you're drawing, because people do say, oh yes, I see a parallel, but they never talk about it in terms of what you've just said, like this idea of these unresolved relationships and somebody searching for somebody else and that sense of yearning and desire for closure.
Yeah,
like I haven't heard that before. That's new, and I like that, and I think that's absolutely right.
Well, I also can't help but think of these books because they're both period pieces. And I wonder how they relate to both you and how you view the world, and also just our current sort of communication landscape. On some level, these are books that are the action is kind of set into place by dispatches from afar and ways of communicating that some of us can't even fathom now, because we are so quick to communicate with one another. We learn things so quickly. And in Washington Black, I mean, many, many miles are traveled and information gets around still. And I find that kind of fascinating in itself. Was your decision to kind of contemplate the way we used to be as people in terms of how we are now, did that come into play at all? Like, it's very fascinating that we communicated this way and that information got around in such ways.
Yeah, I guess not in terms of the circulation of information. That wasn't maybe what I had in mind.
Yeah.
But I think when you set out to do, at least for me, when I set out to do a historical piece, I'm not necessarily looking at the ways in which it speaks to what's going on in our current climate. you know, that's not, at least with these last two novels, that hasn't been the impetus. But certainly when, you know, you're getting to the last drafts, you're sort of noticing things, or you know, early readers are pointing things out. And I just, I can see that.
Yeah.
there are sort of things being enacted in these books that are just, yeah, that I guess maybe do reflect certain things in the climate. I mean, we're still dealing with grave racial injustice and racial inequality. And in the case of somebody like Tana and Washington Black, gender inequality.
Yes.
That, you know, Washington is never going to be recognized for his work, but neither will she. I mean, she's somebody who's obviously devoted all of her adult life to helping her father with what he does, but I mean, she'll never get that recognition.
Yes, her father is, just for people who haven't read it, is basically, well, how would you describe him? I don't want to mischaracterize his vocation, but he's a scientist.
Yeah, he's a marine zoologist,
right.
Which is what we would call like a marine biologist now.
Right. So yeah. You've got these, in Washington Black and in Half-Blood Blues, you have these characters who are, in terms of skill, for the most part, they are at the toppermost of their fields, which I find interesting, but still not... still persecuted. They are precocious, but that's not recognized, particularly by white people. And that's, I mean, I understand where you're coming from with that. But that I will say also that the diction in Washington Black was fascinating. I found myself writing emails in the style of your book, and saying, you know, Waterhouse. I couldn't help it. I don't know why. That's not what it's called. What's the name of a bathroom? That's not, I've said it wrong.
Oh, like a water closet.
Water closet. That's right. I don't know why I said water house. That's weird. Although, so that's, that must have been on some level kind of stylistically kind of fun for you to kind employ this kind of diction in your work.
Oh, completely.
Yeah.
And with Half the Blues as well. Like, it's just, there's a point at which the writing starts, you know, stops being... You know, like you're finding you're muddling your way through, and it's kind of hard. And there's this point where it becomes just easy and like play, and you know exactly how that character would express himself.
Yeah.
And so it was like such a joy to write in both of those voices, but especially, you know, having just written Washington Black, like it was just so much fun to play with this 19th century diction and.
Yeah.
Voice, and it's hard to let go of, like I'm trying to move into something else that's absolutely, you know, not set in that era, and it's so hard to shake that. I'll need an exorcism or something.
Yeah, no, I found it myself. I was writing a press release or something for something, and I couldn't help but it. I wondered what the media might be thinking when I was writing in such a style. But one of the things I appreciate that I recognize this parallel between these two books. And I have kind of a personal question for you, because I do think in both of these books, you seem fascinated by the nature of familial friendship, this notion of really having a close-knit kinship with someone who isn't necessarily your blood. And is that something you relate to on some level in your own life? Or because I've seen it happen now twice, where these characters are bonded with someone, in both cases, for better or for worse, that they're not their family, but they feel as close to family as they possibly could to someone. Do you relate to that?
Yeah. I mean, there's something about, especially like really long-term friendships, where, I mean, that is like blood in a lot of ways. Like that's, it might as well be your blood. It might as well be your family, where this person is, you've known them for so long and you've been through so much with them and it's been up and down and you would almost forgive anything, and you understand that, you know, they accept you as you are, with all of your foibles, and that it's a kind of lifelong thing.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, relationship like Sid and Chip and Half-Blood Blues, that's something where, you know, neither of them seem to be particularly bonded to their families. I mean, they don't talk about their birth families at all. We don't know
where
they've come from.
Yes.
Sid gets into it a tiny bit, but you get the sense he doesn't have a brother he's close to or anything like that. He's quite alone at the end of his life. And he's been married, several times, and none of them have stuck. And you get the sense that he hasn't spoken to those wives in years. And so, the only person who's been a constant in his life since he was really a boy, because they've known each other since they were, 10 or something, is this man who is, Chip, who's awful. Like, he's really awful.
Yes, yes, exactly.
But he's who Sid has. And you just know that these men will be together and be each other's supports and be there for each other, until one of them dies. And that's just what it is to have, a very deep friendship that goes over several decades.
Yeah, and it's particularly touching between Wash and Titch as well, and Washington Black. Like this bond, this sense of loss when they are apart. It's remarkable.
Well, thank you.
Well, you're welcome.
That one was a bit more fraught just because of the huge and power imbalance between that dynamic. So that was a lot more of a ticklish thing to write.
Yeah.
Not to have Titch come across as the great white savior and have this be like a palatable thing, because it wouldn't be. There's such a huge power imbalance that I really felt like that had to be done so delicately.
Yeah, no, and you've done it wonderfully. I hope people will read Washington Black, both books, Half Blood Blues and Washington Black, and I appreciate you fielding questions about both, because I just had this hypothesis that they might seem connected. They were connected to me, and they seem connected on some level beyond your writing. I feel like there's something going on. I just appreciate your work so far, if I might say.
Oh, no, thank you. Thank
you so much. So we've talked about these two different periods that you've covered in these respective works. Do you have a sense of where you might be going next, what the next work might be, and possibly what realm or era you might explore?
I have a general idea of what it is I'd like to do. Mm-hmm. And I don't like to talk about work that I haven't written yet, just because I know if I talk about it, I won't write it.
Yeah.
But definitely something that's not so deeply historical. Like, I feel like I've just gone, my first novel was set in the 60s, and then, Half-Blood Blues was set in the 30s and 40s.
Yeah.
And then this one goes back even further. It's like, where am I going to end up?
Yeah, exactly.
So something, that's probably still a bit historical, mm-hmm. just because I seem to be a writer who's not, into tackling the moment, or I find it hard to kind of grapple with our, ever changing now. Things are moving so quickly.
Yeah, I didn't articulate it very well, but I do feel like in that impulse you are grappling with now, not necessarily by rejecting it, but I see a connection between the way you, the stories you've written and how things used to be and how I just couldn't help but think of now. Like, can you imagine the seafaring adventures and whatever you might like? This is just things that are occurring that just couldn't help. I couldn't help but think of, well, how would we do that now? Whether it'd be easier or not, like, how would we find someone? How would we send a notice that, someone had died or something like that? It's just fascinating. I couldn't help. And I feel like that might be inherent within your impulse to write about seemingly another time.
Yeah, I think that that's absolutely right. I think that maybe delving into the particular historical events that I've written about, it's a way of writing about the now. Like, I guess maybe discussing some of the same strains that are still continuing, or really highlighting how things have changed. But I'm doing it through what for me is like a closed story. Like, we know how that ended.
Yes, that's true. Historically,
so it feels like I can grapple with that, a lot easier than trying to write about you know, say like the Trump presidency or something like this would be, this is something that changes sort of by the minute. And yeah, just this moment feels really hard to get a handle on. So,
yeah. Well, it does, like you said, and as I tried to articulate earlier, I do feel like there's echoes of these kinds of histories in the present moment, and I think that comes through. If people want to learn more about you, I guess online, where would you send them? Do you have a site or a social media presence or anything like that?
I don't. No,
you have nothing.
I think I'm a bit of a ghost. No, I don't have a website, and I don't. I'm not on anything. I have a Facebook page, but it's run by somebody else.
Okay.
But if they wanted to leave me a note, I guess I would direct them to that Facebook page. They're constantly updating it. So maybe the Facebook page would be the place to start.
And that's just under your name?
That's just under my name.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I appreciate this time very much. And I hope this was, I don't know, fun for you.
No, it was great. Yeah.
And I do wish you the best of luck with everything going forward, and thanks again for the time.
Well, thank you so much, Vish.
Special thanks once again to Essie Adugin for appearing on this, the 463rd episode of Creative Control, which is part of the Entertainment One Podcast Network and available on all podcast platforms, all of them, every single one, I think. It's also on things you may not expect, Spotify, YouTube, Audioboom. It's everywhere. It seems to be everywhere. If you can't find an episode that you're looking for, that you've heard about it, but you can't find it on any of the things, or if you want to learn more about me and sign up for my regularly scheduled newsletter, please visit my website, vishkhanna.com. You can like Creative Control on Facebook, follow the show on Twitter at @vishcreative, or follow me at @vishkhanna. You can listen to a radio show version of Creative Control on Wednesdays at noon Eastern Standard Time, around the world at CFRU.ca, or on an actual radio at 93.3 FM if you're in or near Guelph. Also, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation to keep this podcast going. It's getting to the point where I could really use these donations to keep the show going and to feed myself and my family. So please, patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation. If everyone who liked the show on social media and listened to the show pledged $2, I'd be fine. So think about that. If you and your friends all pledged $2, the show's doing just great. So again, patreon.com/creativecontrol. Thank you very much to Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, Planet Bean Coffee, and Granddad's Donuts for their in-kind support for this show. Thank you also to Jim Guthrie for his in-kind support of the show. He lets me use a song of his, The Rest Is Yet to Come, each and every week. Go to jimguthrie.org to learn more about Jim. And that's it. Thank you very much for listening to this show. I enjoyed speaking with Essie very much. These books are incredible. They really are. I hope I put that across to you during the course of this interview. I think I may have overflattered her, and it was embarrassing for her maybe, but it's unbelievable writing. These books are great. So check out Essie and her books. And thank you for listening. And that's it. I have to go. Bye for now.
We're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices.
Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.